From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Today, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said President Trump has mild symptoms of COVID-19 after testing positive last night. Meadows spoke with reporters but declined to give details.
The American people can rest assured that we have a president that is not only on the job, will remain on the job, and I'm optimistic that he'll have a very quick and speedy recovery.
Mark, how would you describe?
Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden tested negative this morning. He wished the president a swift recovery. Biden campaigns in Michigan today as planned.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now. Margaret Tolov is politics and White House editor at Axios, and Tolu Olorunupah, White House reporter for The Washington Post. It's good to have both of you on this monumental day, really. Tolu, start with you. What's the level of concern right now inside the White House?
Well, it's great to be here. There is a lot of concern within the West Wing that they just don't know how bad this outbreak is. I call it an outbreak because you have the president who has tested positive, the first lady has tested positive, one of the president's closest advisors, Hope Hicks, has tested positive. And there is concern that many more people may have tested positive or may be positive without being tested. We learned earlier this morning that Senator Mike Lee of Utah, who was at the White House this weekend and has spent time close to the president and some of his advisors, tested positive recently as well. So this could be a major outbreak infecting a lot of the major figures in the U.S. government. And there's a lot of concern that they just don't know how far this has spread, how to do the contact tracing. This is the president, this is the White House, which has been holding multiple large-scale events over the past recent days. And there are multiple people who have been in touch with White House officials who have not been wearing masks, who have not been practicing social distancing. And it seems like this outbreak could have major implications for the president's reelection and the government that he sits atop of right now.
And we will get to that. But Margaret, Mark Meadows can say that the president is on the job, will remain on the job. He can be optimistic that he'll have a quick and speedy recovery. But we are still very much in the early hours, really, of this news. Do we know at all whether or not this will affect the president's ability to govern the country? And what happens, you know, if these symptoms do worsen?
Yeah, well, thanks again for having us this morning. Meadows' assessment that the president is experiencing mild symptoms, that would not prevent a president from being able to govern. Mike Pence, they're telling us, has tested negative so far today. We know that it takes sometimes several days to know that you are going to test positive. So this is going to be a daily watch now for a while. But even if the president was feeling very sick, I mean, he could be very ill and still be working as president. There is a protocol prescribed largely through the 25th Amendment. Section 3 is the part that we're looking at for anyone who's Googling as they listen. A chain of command that exists. So if for some reason President Trump were actually incapacitated, we know that Mike Pence could take over those duties. If Mike Pence were also to become...
I think we might have just lost Margaret Tolov there. We'll try to get her back on the line. Okay, well, let's go to a piece of tape here. Before the president tested positive, he was on Fox News last night to say that his aide, Hope Hicks, as we've said, also tested positive, and he said that she may not have been able to social distance effectively. Let's listen.
But it's very, very hard when you are with people from the military or for law enforcement, and they come over to you, and they want to hug you, and they want to kiss you because we really have done a good job for them, and you get close, and things happen. I was surprised to hear with Hope.
The chief of staff, Mark Meadows, said that the president got on a helicopter for a campaign trip to New Jersey yesterday. He met with supporters, even though officials had already begun that contact tracing process. You know, what could this mean for the president politically as we learn more in the days ahead?
Well, it means a couple of things. It means, for one, that he cannot campaign as he expected to be campaigning just a few weeks before the election. He cannot be holding these massive rallies. The rally that was scheduled for Friday night has been canceled. A couple rallies scheduled this weekend, also essentially canceled and that the president cannot attend them in person. It also means that when it comes to the message, the president does not want the focus of the final weeks of this campaign to be on the coronavirus. He wants to be talking about the economy reopening. He wants to be talking about the contrast between his vision on policy and Joe Biden's vision on policy. All that is really blown up by the fact that we're going to be talking about coronavirus because the president of the United States has coronavirus, and we're going to be speculating about how healthy he is and the fact that he could not protect himself when he's supposed to be protecting the entire country from this disease, and the fact that more than 7 million Americans have been infected and the White House is now dealing with its own outbreak despite the fact that it has all the advantages that normal people do not have. They have daily testing. They have the best health care, the best doctors, and they couldn't keep this from spreading within the West Wing, means that the president's campaign is going to have to answer a lot of questions about why he should be given another 4 years when the country is really concerned that he has not set the best example. He has not practiced social distancing. He has not been wearing masks. His advisors have not been doing that. And that's why the focus of the last weeks of this campaign will now be squarely on the coronavirus and nothing else, because the president is dealing with this in his own house.
And I wonder to what extent the president can speak to that himself. Margaret Talley, I think you're back with us now. Does the president have any plans to address the nation?
Yeah, we are all waiting to hear from the president on his schedule, his public schedule right now. We know he's scheduled to have a midday conversation that is closed to the press around the topic of, ironically, COVID-19 and vulnerable seniors. But I think beyond that, the president, I certainly expect to hear from him in the coming days. But based on the way the White House and the campaign have projected the image that they want to get across, I don't expect we'll hear from him until his voice sounds good and he looks or sounds healthy. And I don't know whether this will be an address to the nation, whether it will be an interview with Hannity on Fox. At some point, if he's not going to be in a rally venue, the president is going to want to regain control of this narrative. But right now, in these early hours, he's in no place to do that.
At the debate on Tuesday, the president mocked Joe Biden for his coronavirus precautions. And Tola, this is getting back to what you said. Let's listen to the president. He said that that he was doing the right thing to stay safe.
I mean, I have a mask right here. I put a mask on, you know, when I think I need it. Tonight, as an example, everybody's had a test and you've had social distancing and all of the things that you have to. But
just
I wear
like
masks when needed.
Tolu, a good portion of the country does not trust the president on this matter. And I wonder what kind of trust issues might the White House be dealing with as it tries to communicate to the American public and keep things calm, which seems to be what the president wants to do.
Well, the White House has a huge credibility issue, in part because the president himself said that he has tried to downplay the virus, even when he knew about how lethal and how dangerous it was. He told Bob Woodward that he always tried to downplay it because he did not want to create a panic. And we've also seen other White House officials fail to level with the American people about how serious this disease is. And I think because of that and because of the president's inability to keep himself safe, the White House will struggle to be seen as a credible voice in telling the American people to be calm, that everything is fine, that the virus is going to disappear, that everything's on track, that they're doing a good job when, you know, just looking statistically, the United States has struggled more than the vast majority of countries and has the largest death toll of any country on earth. It's really difficult for the White House, especially now that there's an outbreak within the White House, to communicate to the public that they are to be trusted on this disease. I think this is something that they will struggle to do, and the level of transparency that they will need in terms of just telling the American people how the president is doing is going to be very great in terms of trying to figure out how much to believe the White House, how much to believe the official channels versus what we're likely to see, which is a lot of anonymously sourced media reporting about what's happening behind the scenes, which, to remind the listening public, that's how we found out about this in the first place. The media covered Hope Hicks, the president's aide, being infected, and that's how we learned about this.
Margaret, we talked briefly about how this might affect President Trump's campaign, but what about Joe Biden? You know, he was standing next to the president on the debate stage at a distance for 90 minutes on Tuesday night. Have we heard anything from the Biden campaign or what they'll be thinking about in the days ahead?
Sure. Biden has been regularly testing, has been testing negative. But again, with at least a 5-day lag time, we don't know what that really means and how it will affect his ability to continue on the campaign trail in the immediate future. We know Kamala Harris is going to campaign in the immediate future. It would be the ultimate of ironies if the Biden and Harris were the ones on the trail and President Trump were the one at home after all of the basement rhetoric.
That's Margaret Talov, White House and political editor, politics editor at Axios, and Tolu Olorunipa, the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you for bearing with us through technical problems. Thank you both for being here. We're staying with our top story of the day, news that President Trump and the First Lady have tested positive for the coronavirus. Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, what is your reaction first off to this news?
Well, it's obviously shocking to have the President of the United States facing and the First Lady facing a very serious illness. It's a big event, and it's a frightening event, certainly for the nation, and we hope that he recovers. It's also predictable. I mean, given what we've been hearing about the practices in the White House and at rallies, there was a higher likelihood this would happen.
You say it's a higher likelihood. We know, though, in terms of precedent, and that's really what we would love you to look at right now, that it's not the first time there's been a health crisis inside the White House. Let's think back to President Woodrow Wilson about 100 years ago during the flu pandemic of 1918. What happened then?
Yeah, well, that's a very important case where this takes place, his presidency, in the middle of a major pandemic. And historians are pretty convinced that he suffers the effects of the flu. He'll then have a stroke. And in the end of his presidency, he's incapacitated and he's really not running things at the White House. It goes from bad to worse, and it undercut his ability to handle the post-World War I period. And the public really didn't know what was going on. So this is a mark of just how serious the consequences of a major illness can be.
And President Franklin Roosevelt, this is in terms of his own personal health issues, the 1930s and 40s, he had polio. He was very sick during World War II. In fact, he died when he was in office. Let's listen to a little bit of audio now from a radio broadcast announcing that news.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin from CBS World News. A press association has just announced that President Roosevelt is dead. The president died of a cerebral hemorrhage. All we know so far is that the president died at Warm Springs in Georgia.
Julian, how much of a surprise did that come as? Because the general public didn't really know Roosevelt was sick, and that was pretty typical because later President Kennedy had health issues that people didn't know about. I think he had Addison's disease and other serious health issues. What lessons can we draw from that, and how much the public knows and is entitled to know?
Yeah, the public didn't know the severity of FDR's struggle with heart disease, which was diagnosed pretty early in 1944, and the doctor didn't think he could make it through a second term, but the public didn't know that. It's only now when you look back at physical images of him that you could see just how bad he was, which many colleagues suspected. I think the lesson is we should know that, that given this is a Democratic choice, there's no reason to hide major health information about a president. And I think when people look back at FDR, it's not whether he should or should not have been reelected, but it's a question of why not have that information in front of us.
Yeah, and we should say that the media was complicit in that at the time, certainly with John F. Kennedy. It was basically understood that they would sort of look the other way and not let the public know. That's not certainly the situation right now, and it's quite different because there's so much we don't know about the coronavirus and its effects on individuals. But in terms of the larger issue here, these are very uncertain times already. We still don't know how serious the infection will be for specifically the president. When a president does fall ill in some way, what does it do to the psyche of the American public?
Well, it certainly comes as a shock, even if there has been hints that this could happen, as there have been with COVID. There's concerns that emerge naturally about the national security status of the country when the president can't put his or her full attention on that issue. And the president is still the leader of the nation. And so to have the leader incapacitated in any fashion or in a state of physical uncertainty, I think unsettles the democracy. And we'll see that everywhere from public opinion to what happens in the markets and what happens in the economy. So there's many ramifications for this happening.
What is the best thing that a president, a White House, the president's administration can do to try and reassure the American public at a time like this?
Well, I think one thing that's always true is transparency. I think what we've learned since the 1960s is that the public should know, and it's better if they know what's going on. I think the public can gain some sense of confidence, as other leaders of government can and the corporate world, if they understand exactly the severity and how the situation is being contained. In this case, there's another element, because this comes after the president hasn't seemed to take this seriously, from social distancing to wearing masks at events. And so I think the second step is to show that the White House understands that they have to live with the same precautions as all other Americans.
Yeah, but can you imagine that happening right now, especially at this point close to the election? This is one of the things that President Trump has taken a stand on. What could be done to, in many ways, rectify that?
Yeah, what should happen is different than what will happen. And even today, when Chief of Staff Mark Meadows came out, it was noted he didn't wear a face mask. And he's been in contact with the president. So I don't know if there'll be any kind of awakening to what this is about and some subsequent change of behavior. More likely, you know, the president will try to downplay it even as he has it and continue to defend his approach to the pandemic.
So how does that affect the final month of the campaign, both for the president and for Democrat Joe Biden?
Well, we don't know. Obviously, part of this will depend on the symptoms and how long the recovery is. It will take him off the campaign stage to some extent for a while. If Joe Biden is healthy, he'll have more opportunity now to be out there while the president is not. The president will use Twitter. He'll still make statements if he's physically capable of doing it. I think the biggest risk is it for the president. It puts the pandemic front and center, and that's one of his greatest vulnerabilities. So we're talking about the one issue he doesn't want to talk about.
Well, it's good to talk to you on this historic day. Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The coronavirus remains a problem around the world. Britain is one of the countries dealing with a second wave. But despite that, the London Marathon this Sunday is on. The pandemic forced New York, Chicago, Boston, and Berlin to cancel their marathons. In London, the race will just be scaled back. It's limited to a few dozen elite-class men and women, not the 40,000 runners who usually take part. Jared Ward of Utah is the only American in the men's field. He is in London right now. And Jared, you and your fellow runners are basically in a bubble there. Race officials call it a biosecure environment. What's it like?
Honestly, it feels more like an Olympic village than any other race experience that I've had, in that we're just all in here together. We don't leave. We do our runs around this facility for the most part until we are taken over to start the race, and then we're brought back to the bubble. And so, it's different. We all, you know, we wear our masks. Anytime we're out of our rooms, we're wearing these big necklaces that start buzzing and beeping like crazy if you get within 2 meters of another individual wearing one of these things. And so we walk around spaced out in the halls and try to keep our beepers from buzzing on us. And but it's the same people, you know, it's the same friends that I've come used to running with. And so I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be back in a race and in the company that I've grown accustomed to.
What is the oddest thing, though? I mean, if you're that familiar with the your fellow runners and presumably see them all around the world for different marathons, I mean, it must be hard to keep your distance to not have any kind of social interaction, or do you manage that somehow?
You know, I feel like we have managed it. They've spaced the tables out at dining times such that we're 6 feet away when we're eating. We go out on runs still together and jog around, and so we get to see them a little bit. But it is different. You know, I walked into registration and looked up, and Sarah Hall was walking in, and she gave me an air hug from 20 feet away. And while that's different, you know, it carries the same warmth.
And you mentioned Sarah Hall, one of the elite American runners who is there right now. When you run, by the way, and especially run with others, are you wearing a mask?
No, when we're outside doing our training, we're permitted to take off our masks. But we're tested multiple times while we're in here, and the mask procedures along with the testing are to create this safe environment where we can run together, because the idea is at the end of the week we're all unmasked on the start line running a race.
So the actual course is going to be different from what it usually is. Are there going to be any spectators? As we said, you know, 40, 50,000 people usually turn out for these races.
My understanding is that there's not going to be spectators, maybe aside from the few coaches and agents and race officials that are out there on the course. So it will be quiet. It'll be different. In my mind, I've built it out like an old track race late at night under the lights where most of the fans had gone home, and it's just quiet, cool, and running. It kind of feels like a throwback to that era of my life.
That sounds like a great approach. Whether it's strategy or not, it sounds like that's the best thing to do for Sunday.
Well, I hope so. We could talk again on Sunday, and I can tell you if it works.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. Jared Ward is from outside Provo, Utah. He's one of the runners in the elite men's field on Sunday's London Marathon. Really nice to talk to you, and we wish you the best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. It was a pleasure.
On March 11th, the World Health Organization made a major announcement about the coronavirus.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
That same day, two people in Washington, D.C. made a major discovery, each other. 38-year-old Christopher Lee, who's a government analyst, had his profile on a dating app. He wanted somebody he could explore the world with and take to great taco spots in D.C. He found one.
Jennifer Cole, 35 years old, looking for someone to go on adventures with and that likes to eat good food and maybe someone I could practice my German with.
Jennifer's with the Foreign Service. She and Christopher planned to meet up for tacos, but the pandemic changed things. She packed her bags, grabbed her cat, and left D.C. to wait things out with her mom in Wisconsin. But she and her new match, Christopher, stayed in touch.
I was gone for 7 weeks in Wisconsin, and we probably about a week in started FaceTiming every night.
Yeah.
What did you guys talk about?
Just getting to know each other. It was so natural and easy to talk to each other.
Sometimes like in normal like dating life in the city is like hustle and bustle, and you might not be able to actually hone in on these certain points.
And at what point, Jennifer, do you decide that I haven't known this guy very long, but I'm going to move in with him?
So he was really petitioning hard for me to move in with him before we even met in person. Don't roll your eyes. You did.
And Chris, do you have a large apartment?
It's a one bedroom, one bath in D.C., so it's not very large at all.
It's not large.
So in July, you officially moved in together. In August, you got engaged.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard the old adage, you're supposed to spend like every season with somebody before you tie the knot?
No, I actually haven't.
I have not heard that.
Maybe that's just as well. What possessed you though?
Well, I feel like during COVID, like we were around each other like 24/7 and like all day long.
It really accelerated how fast we could get to know each other.
It's like 5 months versus what do you think it would have been otherwise without the pandemic?
Well, you say 5 months, but it was 5 months like all day long, every day. And like without the pandemic, maybe we just saw each other like twice
a couple of times a week. I think we also met each other at just the right time and place in each of our lives. Like we were serious from the beginning.
So you are actually getting married tomorrow. I think you should go off and start getting nervous.
Right.
But what's the wedding going to be like? Is it going to be socially distanced?
Oh, of course. Chris's condo actually has a beautiful rooftop, which with views of DC and all the like greenery on the area. So that's where we're doing everything.
So the roof usually fits like 100 people. We're only going to have about 25, and we're going to have signs printed out like all over the place.
Sanitizing stations.
It's hard to say that this is the wedding you always imagined if you have to have signs around reminding people to keep their distance. But how do you feel about getting married during the pandemic, like a whole pandemic relationship?
To be honest, I have had moments of guilt. There's so many people hurting in the world right now and dying and grieving. But the reaction of most of our families and friends have been, you know, thank God that there's something beautiful and loving happening in the world.
Really nice to speak to you. And thanks for giving your friends and family and us something good amid the pandemic.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. We're really happy to have the opportunity to share a story.
Jennifer Cole and Christopher Lee tie the knot tomorrow in Washington, D.C. Back to our top story now, the news that President Trump and the First Lady have tested positive for the coronavirus and that the president has mild symptoms. World leaders are responding with well wishes. NPR's Frank Langford is following this from the United Kingdom. And Frank, this diagnosis is not new territory in the UK. Earlier this year, Prime Minister Boris Johnson had a serious case of COVID-19. But start, if you will, with what we're hearing from other world leaders about President Trump's case.
Lisa, it's mostly pro forma get-wells, even from people with whom the president has not had a good relationship, like German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Russian President Vladimir Putin, with whom he has a much better relationship, sent a telegram saying, quote, "I'm certain that your inherent vitality, good spirits and optimism will help you cope with this dangerous virus."
And how about Prime Minister Boris Johnson? How's he responding since he's been there?
Well, he has been there, and he had a very, very bad case here, which I'm sure we can talk about in a moment. But he offered the same kinds of wishes and hoped that they would, what he called, stage a really quick recovery.
Obviously, I think we all want to send our best wishes to the president and the first lady, and I've done that this morning, as you can imagine. And I'm sure that they'll both stage a very strong recovery.
Of course, there's been critical press coverage here in Europe and also a little bit in Asia, as you might imagine. Donald Trump not popular in much of Europe. And Hu Xijin, he's the editor of the Global Times. That's a nationalistic state-run paper in China. On Twitter today, he said, quote, "President Trump and the First Lady have paid the price for his gamble to play down COVID-19.
And getting back to Boris Johnson then, who had COVID-19, remind us of how serious it was for him, because at one point he was in intensive care.
It was awful, and I think people here were very, very concerned. He was getting oxygen. They kept him off a ventilator, but he said afterwards there were plans being made for what would happen if he died, and he thought he was very close, potentially, to passing away. So that really rattled people here, because people could see that he was sick, and then off he was, basically out of sight for quite some time in the ICU and in the hospital.
So if they thought that he might not survive, to what extent did the government try to maintain a position that he was still in charge?
Well, they struggled with that. One thing they did at a certain point, and here in the United Kingdom, there's not a written constitution. So the United States is actually in much better shape in managing these kinds of things and uncertainty. But Dominic Raab, who's the foreign secretary, he was sort of first in line for this. And Johnson made it clear that he would assume some of the duties. But there was a period of time, Lisa, where I couldn't tell you who was doing what in the government. And it was clear that Boris Johnson was completely out of it for a number of days in the hospital in the ICU.
What was the knock-on effect of that in terms of the political impact?
I think it really rattled people. People were uncertain whether we were going to still have him as prime minister, and it wasn't clear exactly the direction of the country. Fortunately, this didn't take that long. He came out of ICU after several days and was able to recover, and people were, I think, very relieved by that.
So did it actually ever get close, Frank, to somebody assuming his powers?
Not exactly. It never quite got there. What I think was interesting here is that Johnson was visibly ill early on. The country was consumed with his health, and he was not able to allay those fears because he didn't want to go on camera much. And when people did see him at all, maybe outside of number 10 Downing Street, it was clear he was very sick. And one of the lessons here, I think, is that if you have a leader who's ill like this and ill, and hopefully if they don't have symptoms, it's very helpful to get them out there to allay people's fears early on. And I think that's the challenge that Donald Trump faces right now in the White House, is that this is going to consume people's thoughts in these final weeks of the campaign. And I think the White House is probably going to feel a lot of pressure if they can do this, is to get him out there publicly and make people see that everything's okay, if that's the case.
And President Trump has been accused of not taking the coronavirus seriously enough as a threat. Boris Johnson has been criticized for the same thing, at least at the beginning of the pandemic. Did his having COVID-19 change that for him? Did he change the way he approached the crisis and talked about it?
Initially, yes. And initially, he seemed quite humbled by it. And what happened afterwards, and I got to say, he got a boost when he came out, and he came almost off his deathbed. It was quite dramatic politically, and people rallied around him. But after that, he continued to make a lot of mistakes. So no, I don't think that he became sort of the much more serious prime minister that many people hoped he would.
NPR's Frank Langfitt speaking to us from the UK. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Now you're very welcome, Lisa.
We're going to move for a moment away from the top news of the day. Protests after the killing of George Floyd over the summer brought hundreds of thousands of people onto the streets of the country. There are still some demonstrations happening. Many of the protesters are new to civic action, but with a momentous election looming, there's a question about whether they will vote. Brett Jaspers from member station KERA reports on efforts in Texas to get protesters to the polls.
On a cloudy Thursday, shoppers bustle in and out of an El Rancho grocery store in Fort Worth. A half dozen activists stand at the entrances offering voter registration forms. Yadira Avitia registers one person that evening. She's a volunteer deputy registrar, which means she's legally allowed to help register people here in Tarrant County.
Okay. Gracias.
Daquan Johnson works at the other entrance, asking people if they're registered. He says he does the same thing at protests.
That's how I can be that much more a part of a movement. Like, you go to these protest groups and say, hey, are you registered? Because I see you're protesting, that's fine, but are you going to vote? Because we need that.
Johnson and Avitia are part of the group Enough is Enough Fort Worth. Founder Kwame Osei Jr. says they've broadened beyond the protests.
As we were going to protest, we started going to more city hall meetings and meeting with the chief of police and meeting with Mayor Bessie Price. So that's where we started to shift the focus to and more community based. Because if we don't change anything in legislation, then nothing's going to happen.
Organizations like this one want to reform how cities, states, and the federal government spend tax dollars and govern policing. That takes influencing elected officials or electing new ones. But many of the summer's protesters were teenagers taking civic action for the first time. And the voting habit doesn't happen automatically.
As candidates, we also have to do our part.
Democrat Jasmine Crockett won her July runoff for a Texas State House seat by less than 100 votes. She says her campaign registered hundreds of people she met at protests.
Grassroots is the way to go, no matter what, especially when you're talking about the younger voter or the voter that's normally disengaged. Because for them, they're looking at it and they're saying, well, I see president, but I don't see the rest of you. And so you've got to make it to them some way, somehow.
It's the relationship a candidate forms with a potential voter, Crockett says, that turns them out. Because people don't necessarily know what a state representative does or what role that person plays in setting policy. Daniel Renty agrees. People are still learning how local government functions. Renty works for a church in Frisco, a city just north of Dallas. He volunteered to help organize a protest in the city back in June. Thousands turned out. Now he's helping with a local voter registration drive.
I haven't been the most involved on the state level. You know what I mean? It gets often neglected. And that's where it's kind of shifted my attention to, is how we can locally get more involved.
One group that's been on the ground for years is the Texas Organizing Project, or TOP. Deputy Director Brianna Brown says her staff and volunteers tried to have meaningful yet socially distant conversations with protesters this summer. But she says the election isn't their only goal.
More critical for us is, like, how do we figure out real and meaningful ways for people to be engaged beyond the election.
Brown's group made about 1,200 new contacts across the state during the recent protests. About 80 Dallas-area residents attended a follow-up Zoom meeting. Topp's work with these new activists is centered around policy issues like the city's police budget. The group also plans to contact over 1.5 million voters this fall, mostly people of color.
Protest to power building is what organizing, you know, is all about.
Back at the El Rancho grocery store, interactions with potential voters are fleeting. There's little time for a deep conversation. But Kwame Ose Jr. of Enough is Enough Fort Worth says they do happen. When he meets a person who says his or her vote doesn't matter, he calls on an analogy.
I say, say it's you and you have a sibling, and that sibling is putting 5 cents a day in their piggy bank, and you're not putting nothing in your, into your piggy bank. Who's going to have more money?
Saving money over time, he tells them, is like consistent voting, where you build up political influence. It's by voting, he says, that activists can get closer to results they want. For Here and Now, I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
We'll get back to the day's top story that President Trump has been infected with the coronavirus. But first, a closer look at the wildfires in the West and the danger they pose to the environment. Scientists are just beginning to understand how these catastrophic fires are leaching cancer-causing chemicals like benzene into the groundwater. Andrew Welton is an associate professor of civil engineering at Purdue University. He's often called in when there's an issue with the community's water. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and in fact, you've been called into California to look at the water after some of these big fires over the years in the state. What have you found?
Well, in 2017, after the Tubbs fire, I got called about 3 months after the fire when the city of Santa Rosa was getting worn out trying to flush out the contamination from their system. And they had not thought ahead about the fact that the contamination can actually go into the infrastructure and takes a while to come out. So I've been involved since 2017. In 2018, we got called in after the Camp Fire, the fire that devastated Butte County, California, including the town of Paradise.
And in both of those cases, how did people first realize that there might have been a problem with the drinking water?
Well, in Santa Rosa, they issued a boil water advisory for the 13 homes that were still left standing in the area that was affected by the fire. But a month later, the water company got a call that somebody had some smelly water in their house. So the utility went out, smelled it. It smelled like petroleum, and they did some testing at fire hydrants, and they were the first to really discover that you can have widespread chemical contamination of the water after wildfires. The odor that people detected in the water after the Tubbs fire was by luck, because some of the chemicals that can show up after wildfires in your drinking water, you can't smell when they're harmful. So I think it was just by chance and by luck that they had an odor in their water. They did testing and they found it.
How do those chemicals get into the water? Is it melting pipes or something like that?
Yeah, so that's up for debate still. There's been a lot of focus on plastics and materials either melting or burning. But there's another theory out there where you have smoke that's generated from burning structures or burning vegetation, and it has particles in the air and gases, and those get sucked into hydrants and broken pipes that contaminate the water.
In one water sample that was taken, benzene levels were several thousand times higher than what the EPA considers safe. Just remind us of the risk here.
Yeah, so it's pretty serious. You know, initially when they started testing after the Tubbs fire in Santa Rosa, they found, you know, 8 parts per billion of benzene in water. In the long-term exposure limit in California is 1. The federal limit's 5. Wow. But as they went and tested more and more, what they found 40,000 parts per billion of benzene in the water. And the U.S. EPA, from a waste standpoint, sets basically a hazardous waste threshold of about 500 parts per billion. So you can have some pretty substantial levels of chemical contamination in your drinking water. Similar levels were found after the campfire.
Do you think people were consuming that water?
Well, I know people were consuming the water that was contaminated, even though there was some advisories telling people not to. Some people after the campfire called me from the area, people who said that they took showers in potentially contaminated water and felt nauseous or lightheaded and other types of self-reported symptoms.
Well, what about now? I mean, it's been several years since the two fires you were talking about, but now we've got new fires, it seems like, every day in California. Is it safe to drink the water in places like Paradise several years now afterward?
So after the Tubbs fire, Santa Rosa really threw the book at their issues. They threw their entire laboratory at it because they had their own laboratory, and they tested really the heck out of the water. So Santa Rosa went through methodically and replaced contaminated assets and fixed a lot of the damage, got all the contamination out. Paradise has done that too now, but what's still happening is that homeowners who haven't rebuilt might have contaminated service lines that go from the meter to their house. And so the contamination's likely not completely removed from the area in Paradise, but it definitely has been removed by the utilities.
So it sounds like you're saying to me that we're in the early stages of our understanding of how these fires are impacting our health. You know, the air, yes, but also, of course, the water. So how do you fix a problem like this?
Yes, we are in the early stages. And what I mean early is we don't know where the contamination comes from. We don't know if it's coming from burning plastics and smoke and vapors, or if it's one or the other. Right. So if I go into a city of 20,000 people and I just take 5 water samples and I don't find anything, the question is that enough? Did I go to the right places or did I just luck out and go to the wrong places?
Andrew Welton is an associate professor of civil engineering at Purdue University and a frequent water quality consultant called in after big fires in California and elsewhere. Andrew, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dell.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.
How will the news of President Trump's positive coronavirus test affect the presidential campaign with just about a month to go before Election Day? That's next time on Here and Now.